Because of a famine, this family decides to leave. They pack their bags, and they're going to head out of Bethlehem, out of Israel, to go and try and find some food. They're not planning to be gone long, but this temporary evacuation turns into a long stay elsewhere, which, to be fair, is not uncommon during times of tragedy. I've had the privilege and opportunity to spend a bunch of time in post-Katrina New Orleans. In the immediate before and after of Katrina, the city lost 254,000 people from its population. People left. There was nothing to come back to, so they didn't come back. And even now, the population has continued to increase, but as of July 2015, the population is at 386,000, or 100,000 less than in the year 2000. 100,000 people less in New Orleans decided just no reason to come back. So it's not uncommon for people to leave because of some tragedy and head elsewhere and then decide to not come back, to settle down in that new place. The difference here is that the family in our story, and inevitably, this is not the only family that decided to pack up and head out of Judah in search of food, but the story's focusing on them. The difference between them is that they're going to leave Bethlehem, that is, they're leaving the place that is the house of bread to find food. They're leaving the place of God's promise to find fulfillment elsewhere in Moab. That the leaving of Israel, the leaving of Bethlehem, is the leaving of their God. It is this family is spiritually wandering away from the Lord. They're running away from God. That this was not just a physical famine, but a depiction of the spiritual reality of their hearts as well. So while in Moab, the two boys, the two sons, they grow up, they marry locals. We've now got three couples, Elimelech and Naomi, and their two sons and their wives, until tragedy strikes again when Elimelech dies, and Mahlon dies, and Chilion dies. Naomi is left alone with no husband, no sons, just her two daughters-in-law, not even really any hope for a future left for her. So she tries to push Orpah and Ruth away. Orpah, she convinces to go home, back to her family. Ruth says, I'm going with you. Eventually, Naomi concedes and just stops talking to Ruth as they journey back to Bethlehem. So here we are, where our text picks up today, is we've got one poor widow and another poor widowed foreigner in Bethlehem, nowhere to live, no food to eat. And that's where our text picks up in Ruth chapter 2. So if you're able, I invite you to stand for the reading of God's word. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, the Lord be with you. And they answered, the Lord bless you. Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, she is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers. So she came, and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest. Then Boaz said to Ruth, now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn. Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner? But Boaz answered her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Then she said, I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants." And at mealtime, Boaz came to her, said, "Come and here and eat some bread. Dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain. And she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also pull out some from the bundles for her, and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her." So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed is the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I had worked today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." And Ruth the Moabite said, "Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close to my young men until they have all finished my harvest.'" And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted." So she kept close to the young woman of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvest, and she lived with her mother-in-law. Lord, this is your word. Take it and apply it to the hearts of your people, that we might rejoice in the salvation and in the kindness that is poured out by your Son, Jesus. Amen. Please be seated. So this morning I want to start with my conclusion. This could be a really profound conclusion, so be ready. God is at work. All right, you guys all got that? Okay, good. Woo! And some of you are like, okay, well, if you already gave the conclusion, why don't we just end here then, right? So I need to ask, do any of you know what this thing is called? I know some of you may not be able to see it very well, but I really have no idea what this is called. What it is used for is for, like, sucking babies' noses to help them breathe better. I typically call it the brain sucker outer or the make baby screamer. Either one of those would be acceptable answers. But you put it in the baby's nose and you squeeze it to have it suck the gunk, the junk out of the baby's nose so that the baby can breathe. It's often a two-parent job. One, to bear hug the baby who is weeks or months old and you did not know had that level of strength in them to wiggle and writhe out of your arms. And the other, to administer the treatment. As a parent, I can tell you with all level of definitiveness that babies hate this. Every single one of them that I've ever encountered, all of my babies hated this. They scream bloody murder like the world is coming to an end. But let me tell you something. Parents do it because they love their child. Because they see something that is keeping their child from experiencing life, from breathing. And so they administer this, that in the moment the baby is screaming, but the result is the nose is clear, the baby can breathe freer. I think much can be said the same for Naomi in our story here. She's hardened her heart against the Lord, believing that he is against her. She's lost everything, her home and her cherished family. She's allowed bitterness to creep in and grab hold of her heart. And she's holding on to the well-worn sadness of grief. And she can't see God's faithfulness and kindness at work. like the baby getting its nose sucked, Naomi is unable to see past her sadness to see the hands of a loving father caring for his beloved child. So now we've seen the conclusion that God is at work in Naomi's life. She can't see it yet, though. So as we get into our passage for today, we need to stop for a quick literature lesson. You didn't know you were going to get a literature lesson today, but in literature, there are times when the narrator gives some information to the reader so that the reader knows something before the character in the story knows. We call that the reader's advantage, that we're standing outside of the story reading, and it's a scene unfolds, but we've got information that the characters in the story don't have. We see this a lot when we watch movies. For example, ladies, if it's ever really dark and stormy, lightning crashing all around you, and the only light that you have is a single flashlight, don't go into the creepy old house. Nothing good when a lady by herself goes with just a flashlight in the middle of a storm decides to explore a creepy old house. And if you do decide to go into the house, try the light switches first. That's the part that I never understand. Like, they decide they're going to explore the whole house with the flashlight. Nobody ever tries the light switches in those scenes. But we know something bad's about to happen, right? Because we, standing outside of the story, know something that the character in the story, in the movie in that case, doesn't know. Well, I think that that's what we have here in verse 1. We've got some reader's advantage. The narrator is giving us some information that the character in the story don't know yet. Look at verse 1. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. See, we as the readers are introduced to this new character in the story, Boaz. Boaz isn't going to actually enter until a couple verses later, but the narrator wants to make sure on the front end we know a little bit about Boaz. And so we are given a reader's advantage of two things in particular here that we are told about Boaz. The first is that he's a relative. That he's some sort of a cousin of Elimelech. And the second is that he's a worthy man. So before we even meet Boaz in the story, we're given a little bit of insight into who he is. He is a relative, and he's a worthy man. He's full of integrity. Now remember that we have the advantage that when Ruth meets him in a couple of verses, she doesn't know all this yet. But we get to read with the advantage of the narrator's already kind of clued us in a little bit. Okay, that's the end of our literature lesson for today. Now down to verse 2. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain with after him in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." In the Mosaic Law, we see in Leviticus 19, again in 23, and in Deuteronomy 24, the law requires that landowners would leave the edges of their field available for the poor, for widows, for sojourners, those who are in the greatest need, to come and to pick off up the scraps around the edges of the field. This is called gleaning. And so Ruth says to Naomi, "How about I go out and I glean? How about I try and find us a little bit of dinner for tonight?" And I think for the first time in the story so far, Naomi agrees with a comment that Ruth makes. Though I would suggest not for the reason that we might be inclined to believe. It's not in order to have some food for tonight. I think it's because, as we saw last week, what Naomi has wanted more than anything up to this point in the story is to be left alone in her self-pity. And so for the first time in the story, Ruth is offering to go somewhere else, and so Naomi's, "All right, good, go ahead." So that Naomi can kind of stay behind in her pity and her misery. She is caught up in her sadness, and she kind of wants to stay there at this point. So three things I want us to see from Naomi, that we can see this desire of hers to be left alone in her well-worn sadness. The first is that Naomi makes no effort to go and help Ruth. Now, as best as we can tell, Naomi at this point in the story is probably early to mid-50s. So she's not too old to be working. In fact, they just walked from Moab back to Bethlehem. So Naomi just demonstrated her physical capacity by walking 50 plus miles. She's physically capable. So why does Naomi not say, you know what, it's a good idea. We'll probably be more successful if both of us go. If both of us go out to the field, maybe we'll be able to get a little bit of extra. Naomi makes no such suggestions. No indication that she has any intent to help. In fact, she sends Ruth. Oh yeah, good idea. Go ahead, Ruth. Makes no indication that even though she seems to have the capacity and ability, she's not going to make any effort to help Ruth in this endeavor to go and find some food for them. That's the first thing about Naomi that we see. The second is that she never mentions a family relative. So Ruth is going to go out and try and collect some food for dinner. Wouldn't it have made sense for Naomi to say, you know what, here would be a great place for you to start. We've got like a cousin, one of Elimelech, your father-in-law, one of his relatives that owns that land over there, owns that farm. Why don't you start there? It may not be the end, but like that's a good place to start. At no point in this story does Naomi suggest to Ruth, hey, we've got a relative, that might be a good place to start your search. Third, she never warns Ruth about the dangers that she's walking into. A poor, widowed, foreign woman who's incredibly vulnerable. And yet, contrast that when Ruth, meets Boaz, literally the first words we have recorded from Boaz to Ruth, verses 8 and 9. Then Boaz said to Ruth, now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? Naomi says nothing of the sort, that, hey, that's a dangerous job you're walking into. Be careful. Yet literally the first words that are recorded from Boaz to Ruth are, stay here in this field, don't go anywhere else, stick close to those women, and I told all those dudes, hands off. Why does Naomi give no such warning or caution to Ruth? My conclusion is that, still at this point, that Naomi is not terribly concerned about Ruth's well-being. She's not terribly worried. All she sees is that for the first time in months, the Ruth is going to go off and do the thing that she's wanted all along, which is leave her alone. Skip down to verse 22, because Ruth goes out and works for the day, comes back to Naomi, and is going to tell the story of what happened, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. But notice what Naomi says at the very end of the chapter. Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted. Would that have been information that would have been more useful previously? So we've got three things here from Naomi. First, makes no effort to go and help in the food collection process. Second, doesn't even kind of steer Ruth in the right direction and say, hey, we've got a relative, that might be a good place to start, instead of leaving Ruth to go out and figure out where she's going, cross her fingers and hope it works out all right. And third, doesn't even warn her about the physical dangers of what she could be walking into. And I think this all comes back to the spot where for Naomi, caught in her sadness, in her grief, in her sorrow, in her bitterness, that she just wants to be left alone to wallow in it. The place that we ended last week, where she's trying to push people away, caught up, she cannot see past her own sadness right now. See, I think as humans, we often tend toward one of two responses towards sadness. The first is, like Naomi, the inclination to just want to wallow in self-pity, to be caught up in our sadness, and just to be kind of left alone in that space. The second is to pretend that it's not even there. One of the things that I did on my sabbatical is I went to Colorado and spent a few days with a pastor who's a good friend out there. And we just spent a couple days kind of talking and sharing life. He and his wife told me they have friends who play what they call the glad game. I never heard of the glad game before. But here's how the glad game works. Whenever you're having a bad day or sad about something or there's some grief or sorrow, you just think a happy thought and make it all better and make it go away. That strikes me as maybe among the most dishonest things that one could possibly do. Now, that's different than rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice, of trying in the midst of our sadness, in the midst of our sorrow, trying to rest in the Lord's goodness even when we can't see it. That's different. The glad game, where we're just going to pretend it's all better, is not a good or helpful or particularly biblical response to sadness. But it's one that we are drawn to, either to be stuck in it and can't see our way out, or to pretend it's not there. And I think the problem with either of these responses is that we won't be able to see God's covenantal faithfulness at work. When God starts to move, when God's at work, we're not going to be able to see if we're responding in either of those places. Sadness is real. Grief and sorrow and mourning are real. They're temporary. We can hold on to the promise that one day they'll be gone forever. Praise God. But that doesn't mean we deny their reality in the present. Instead, we can ask how God's being faithful through them. So I want to jump from Naomi caught in her well-worn sadness to the extravagant kindness of Boaz. First, let's talk about his character. We already saw a little bit in verse 1, a relative, a worthy man he's called, but there's much more. Boaz, we find verse 4, "And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, 'The Lord be with you.' And they answered, 'The Lord bless you.'" Boaz goes to check on his field. You can learn a lot about somebody by the first words that they say. The first words that are recorded here from Boaz are words of blessing over his employees. "The Lord be with you." I think that's pretty cool. But then we flip it around, and then if you want to know what other people think of somebody, listen to the words that they use to speaking to him. The first words that are spoken to him from his workers are, "The Lord bless you." So the first thing we have, the first information we have as Boaz enters the story is words of blessing upon his workers, and then his workers bringing the Lord's blessing down upon him. That's powerful. The second, verse 5, "Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, 'Whose young woman is this?'" Boaz immediately recognizes that there's somebody new, a new girl out in the field. Poor beggars who were scrounging on the edges of the field from whatever distance away probably had a tendency to look a fair amount alike. And yet Boaz knows his field, knows the people that come there well enough that he sees somebody who doesn't recognize immediately. He's showing great attention not only to his employees but to those on the fringes. The third is that he's actually following that law from the Mosaic law to leave parts of the field unharvested. Imagine we're coming out of years of famine. And for the first time in years, there's a good harvest on the way. The temptation to try and make sure that you get every last bit of it. It's been hard years. We've been in a recession. It's been tough times in the stock market. Companies have been taking a beating. All of a sudden, there's this huge harvest coming. It had been real easy for Boaz, and I imagine the temptation for all the landowners in Israel would have been really strong to have just kind of ignored that particular rule this time. So we learn a lot about Boaz's character that even through what must have been a very strong temptation, that he is going to be faithful and leaves the edges of the field available for the poor to come. So we see a lot about Boaz's character, but now we get to see the extravagant kindness that he pours upon a poor, widowed, foreign woman in Ruth. So with my son Jeremiah, started over the last several years, been trying to teach him how to treat and interact and with women. Starting with his sisters right now, and we focused on three things. Provide, protect, and respect. That it's his job as a man to provide. And that doesn't always mean physically, but emotionally and spiritually as well, to attend to the needs, starting with his sisters. And then to protect them. So from the time he was little and we started working on this, that we'd go for a family walk and he'd want to be in front and he'd like find like some stick and he'd hold it out in front, and then my two daughters, his sisters and mommy, would be in the middle, and then daddy would be at the back of the line when we went on a walk so that he could be in front to protect them, because the walk down the street to Walgreens on the sidewalk, it must have been very dangerous. But he knew it was his job to protect his sisters. And then to respect them, as fellow image bearers that God made and God loved. Those are the three things that I've worked on with my son. And I think we see them all so clearly in the way that Boaz interacts here with Ruth. First, he protects her. As we already saw, the first thing he does is lay out boundaries. Stay here, stay in a group with the other women, told those other guys not to touch you. He's take steps to protect her. But then he provides for her in extravagant ways. Verse 14. And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some bread, and dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her the roasted grain. And she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. I think this is an amazing verse here. First, he invites her to join him for lunch. "Don't stay on the outside, Ruth. Come on and come over here. We're eating lunch over here." But then, not just for lunch, but for a hot lunch of roasted grains. Naomi and Ruth have probably not had a whole lot of hot meals in their recent past. So the thought of a hot roasted grains. Oh, and dip your bread in the wine. So we've got a hot lunch with wine for a woman who is hoping today she might be able to scrape together enough that she and Naomi would be able to eat something small for dinner. And then there's leftovers. The extravagant kindness of Boaz to Ruth. It describes her as satisfied. When was the last time that this poor, widowed foreigner was satisfied after a meal, had truly eaten enough? So that's the immediate, that meal that is described. But look at the way the collection process is described of what happens next. First, he tells the workers to let her glean among the sheaves, not just the edges. So he tells the workers, it's okay, she doesn't need to stay on the very edges of the field. If she goes in and is taking stuff from in the middle, that's okay, let her go. So she's already getting some of the good of the harvest, not just the scraps. And then tells them to pull some of their barley out from their bundles and leave it behind for her. Like they've got it all packaged up and like, whoops, well, oh, there's a little bit. So now she's not even having to do the work. They already collected. They already did the harvest. Now all she has to do is pick it up and gather it. And in third, verse 17 tells us how much she collected. She collected about an ephah of barley. Now, some of you in your baking at home may use ephahs as measurements, but I'm going to assume most of us do not and don't have a sense of how much an ephah is. An ephah is between 25 and 50 pounds. Imagine one of those really big bags of dog food that you would get that like you're like walking out of the store like this. She came hoping to get enough that she and Naomi would have dinner that night, and she leaves with leftovers from lunch and a month's worth of food for them. Boaz provides extravagantly for Ruth and Naomi. And then the respect that he shows to her, the way that he defers her. Ruth even asks, "Why are you treating me like this? I'm a foreigner." Notice there's a response in verses 11 and 12. Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." He sees somebody who has trusted. He sees somebody who has trusted in the Lord and respects her and sees God at work in her, maybe before she even knew herself what was happening. Finally, for this morning, we need to return back to Naomi. Ruth returns from her day at work, gleaning in the fields. All the stories she's got to tell Naomi now. Imagine that as much as she was capable holding this big bag of the barley, she's skipping most of the way home. She's so excited. It's been more than she could have ever imagined for the day. There's food from the leftovers for dinner tonight. There's food for the next month. Two things I want us to see here. The first is God's providence at work. Verse 3, "So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech." I love that word, happened. Some happy accident. She was just stumbling along and somehow ended up in that field, right? No. This was not some cosmic accident that she just ended up in Boaz's field. Of all the fields in all the region of Bethlehem, why that one? Why did she go to a field belonging to a relative she didn't even know she had yet? God's providence on full display. He's working for the good of his children, for Ruth and for Naomi, as he promises to do for each of us. And then Naomi, the prodigal. Our story started with Naomi wandering, running from Bethlehem, running from God. As Elimelech and her son and their sons die, she descends into bitterness, convinced that God is against her. Naomi is a spiritual runaway. And yet here we see Naomi's heart start to thaw. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, this is verse 20. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living and the dead." For a woman who is convinced that God had forgotten her and abandoned her and was against her, This is a stunning declaration, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. She was pretty sure that God had forgotten her. And yet, when she sees what God does through Boaz and through Ruth, the heart of her heart starts to thaw. Notice that word again, kindness. It's the word we've looked at a few times already, the Hebrew word hesed. God's covenantal faithfulness, his steadfast love, his loyal love that pursues his children. Now, did it just show up in the story at this point? No. But only now is Naomi starting to see how God has been faithful through and through. She's starting to see the kindness of the Lord. For us, we've been said that we are to identify in the story with Naomi. We who are prone to run away from the Lord, who to think God is against us, to think that he's out for us, that he doesn't have our best interest in mind, that we need to provide for ourselves and get bitter when things go wrong, caught up in our own sadness. And yet the great encouragement for us this morning, even as we prepare in a moment for communion, is to be reminded of God's covenantal faithfulness. That he's a God who pursues us. That he's a God that knows when we're far off and is faithful even there, because he is a God who does not let go. That we come and we partake of a meal not for those who have stayed close, but for a meal for those who ran away from God and he came and got them back. That just as we see the thaw starting in Naomi's heart as she experiences the kindness of the Lord in ways that she had thought were no longer possible, we are invited through Jesus to experience God's covenantal faithfulness that comes and gets us even when we try and run away from him.